Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we're giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic. And we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music.
Hey, welcome to the 116th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. I'm Matt Enlow.
And I'm Oren Kaplan, and today we have Peter Atencio. He is a director of many things. He directed the first three seasons of Key & Peele. He is doing a new pilot for ABC right now. He has directed Last Man on Earth. He did the movie Keanu. He has just done a bunch of things. Both Matt and I have kind of been in his sphere for a long time. Matt knows him personally, but I've just kind of seen his name around, and we've been really excited to get him on the show.
Yeah, we dive in on what it takes to prep a show, his approach on how to add a ton of style to what would easily be dismissed as like a straightforward comedy sketch. Basically everything that made the visual style of Key & Peele special, he's managed to carry with him throughout all the rest of his career.
Yeah, I really like it when our guests kind of give us the good and the bad of directing, and I think Peter is really very honest about his experiences, and it's great to hear.
Yeah, his highs are high and his lows are low. But before we talk to Peter Atencio, Oren, what have you been working on lately?
Well, I have been working on these same two things that we have talked about. I'm doing this campaign for Comcast, which I'm getting excited about. It's been super stressful, but you know, as you get closer to the shoot date, things start locking in. The shot list gets approved by the agency, all that stuff, and I just feel more and more confident. And our producer on this job does this awesome thing, which I was showing you earlier, and that at the end of every day, he sends a schedule mm-hmm. for tomorrow. It's kind of like a call sheet for prep. It's like, tomorrow we're going to have this call at 8, we're doing this fitting at 9, we're doing this casting at 1 p.m., and then he'll have like a one line for what's happening for the rest of every day up until the shoot. And it's awesome. Like it's just great to really have someone reminding you everything. And he's really very communicative. Like whenever we're on a scout or anything, anytime I need to be anywhere, he'll text me the address like an hour before I need to be there.
It's pretty nice.
And I just click on it and it goes to my GPS, you know? So I don't know. I've really enjoyed this kind of highly efficient prep phase. Also, the other thing, people have heard me talk about Origami for a long time over the course of this podcast. It was like a show that I'd pitched and was picked up, and I was supposed to go to Toronto to shoot and then maybe be the showrunner of. And as of today, I found out that the whole structure of how the show is going to be made is changing mm-hmm. and I'm not going to do it anymore. And it's like, it's disappointing, but also like a relief. And I'm still going to be attached to the show, but I'm not going to Toronto. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. It's a weird feeling. I'm sure we've all been in that place where we're like, this job is going to be really hard and I don't know how I'm going to do it. And then it turns out you're not going to do the job. And then you're like, ah.
Yeah.
You know? So it's like, it's that feeling.
And yeah, you wanted the job because it's a job.
No, but also it's a cool job. It's a cool position. It's a cool project. I like the people I'm working with.
But there's the relief of you knew exactly how hard and challenging and maybe personally taxing this one was going to be, right? Like, I think the relocation thing was a thing that was stressing you out a lot beyond just the normal stresses of directing locally. Like, having to go literally to a different country can be a challenge, as we'll talk with Peter about.
Right. Yeah, I think Peter has some interesting insight. And I do think, like, just trying to look from outside of myself for a second, you know, a lot of times on this podcast, we tell people, like, you should just move to LA because that's, like, where the work is. But then I'm, like, crying about going to Toronto for, like, a few months. It's like, you know, maybe it isn't that easy to just, like, lift up your whole family and your pets and your dog and move to LA.
Yeah, you literally would have a team of people who's, like, have the job of feeding you every day and telling you where to be and driving you places, and really just, like, your family has to, like, come with you and, you know, put their lives on hold, but your life is still, like, on track in a really obvious way, and that stresses people out. I had the same thing. Like, I was traveling with this previous job, all that Ellen stuff. I was traveling all over the place, and I was like, I'm so tired, and I have to go to all these great places, and my life is awesome, and I don't know why I'm sad.
Yeah. Mm. Well, anyway, I guess it's part of the business.
Yeah,
if you get super stressed and super bummed and happy once in a while.
Happy all the time, too. Yeah.
So I'm excited about all that. But I'm still doing this other pilot, and we've found this Oval Office set.
Ooh, cool.
We have a scene that takes place in the Oval Office, which is not that oval. It's actually got these, it's kind of like more of a hexagon.
Hmm.
Turns out, who knew? Probably everyone but me. But yeah, I'm excited for that. So yeah, what have you been working on lately?
Yeah, so I am, like I said, I'm wrapped on all that other stuff. So I'm in heavy development mode. I spent most of the day either emailing or writing, and I had a great time. But the thing I wanted to talk about this week is, like, I've been planning this trip kind of for a while now where we're going. So my wife's movie takes place in San Francisco. So we're kind of going up as, like, a scouting slash, like, meeting trip, basically, kind of like reconnecting with people. And, like, we kind of had been dragging our feet on, like, setting up a lot of, like, important meetings. Do you know what I mean? Like, a lot of, like investment meetings and, like, talking to small business owners and kind of like the more businessy stuff. And it's like very outside of our comfort zone, but it's also a thing that you have to do as a filmmaker. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just a part of the job of, like,
your job is convincing people to help you make the stuff you want to make.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And we are so practiced and focused on the making, right? Like, we know our cameras and we know our casting and we know, you know, like, that we've been doing all of this, the fun stuff. And, like, we intentionally bought these tickets to go up to San Francisco with the knowledge that, like, that was an artificial deadline. Like, we just kind of picked them arbitrarily. It was, like, after Memorial Day weekend, and I knew I was going to be wrapped on this shoot, but it was still early enough out that we could take the time that it's going to be to foster these relationships a little bit. Pardon me. All of which is to say, today was the kind of the drop dead on emailing a lot of those people. And it's this thing that's scary. And also, as soon as you do it, you start getting responses from people and you start taking steps forward. And that's the way it is with all filmmaking. But for whatever reason, because it was a little out of our comfort zone, it was just like, it was hard, you know? And I think that I was like, oh, this will be a good takeaway for the show. Just reminding people, like, you just take that first baby step, basically. And no matter what the answer is, that's a step forward. Whether it's like, hey, I don't have time to sit down with you, go fuck yourself. Or like, I'm not the right person for this. Or I know 16 people who would be great for this. Like, we got all of those different combinations, and we'll continue to do so. And they all are empowering.
Right. I find something interesting is that, like, the most successful people I know, who are probably the types of people you're reaching out to, since, you know, you're trying to find people that can help on this project, they are really good at emailing back very fast, right?
Oh,
like,
yeah,
have you noticed that?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Every, like, the most successful people I know, like, they will respond within an hour with, like, a 5-word email.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's always,
you know, send those things to me. Do that, like connect me with someone. Or
it's not like, hey, I'm so glad you reconnected. It's been too long. How have you been? How is the wife and kids? Blah blah blah. It's like,
I'll have so and so schedule a call.
Yep. Yeah. And sometimes it's a little more flowery than that, and sometimes it takes longer than an hour. But I guess my real point is, it's empowering. Talking to people, asking for help, taking steps forward. It can be scary, but it feels great.
Yeah, do it.
Just shoot it.
Just shoot that email over.
There we go. We got there eventually.
Cool.
Well, before we talk to Peter, real quick reminder, everyone, that we've got a Patreon page. And if you want to contribute to the show, it helps us grow, helps support our editors. We're trying to bring bigger and better things to the table. And we should get on
another live show.
It's time to do it. It'll be fun.
We did just do a crossover episode.
That's true.
So, you know.
We're doing all sorts of stuff, but it's been fun. I hope people have noticed, like, the show is getting a little bit better and more consistent, and it's going to continue to grow and get better and better. So thanks, everyone.
You can find out more about that at patreon.com/justshootitpod.
Thanks for that. Without further ado, here's Peter Atencio.
Hey, we are here with Peter Atencio. Thanks for coming over. We've been trying to get you on the podcast for a very long time.
It finally happened.
I did it.
It happened.
I believe that you were not a father when we first asked you about it.
That's very possible.
That's
yeah.
probably true.
Yeah. Actually. There's been a lot of things that have been put on hold.
How was his high school graduation?
So good.
Cool.
Beautiful ceremony.
And I do think it's funny, like, a lot of the directors that we invite on the show that are kind of like, you know, floating around your level. A lot of them, like, are having had kids. And I do wonder sometimes if there's this kind of weird Hollywood thing of, like, once you kind of get your foot in the door.
Little, like, financial security.
Feel more comfortable like, having a kid.
I still don't know if I can afford a kid, but it definitely, I would say the reverse is true, that having a kid kind of matures you a lot.
Oh, interesting.
Makes you go, like, oh, I got to, like, really get it together and take this as seriously as possible.
I feel like didn't Francis Ford Coppola has a quote about that? Like, not knowing what, like, adulthood is about. Yeah, he's that kind of guy, I guess.
I mean, he also has, like 20 kids.
20 kids, probably. Yeah, and they're all entrepreneurs.
Yeah, all the Coppolas,
Cool, well, thanks for coming, man. You have been doing a ton of stuff, but let's go back a little bit, actually, because I don't know. Did you go to film school?
Kind of.
Oh, good. This is a good answer.
I went to sort of a high school that had a film program. Mm-hmm. I mean, I did go there, but it was a public
here in
school.
LA or?
No, in Denver, actually, where I'm from. It's a public school that was an arts-focused public school, and you had to audition to get in, and then you had to audition every year to stay there. So it was a very unique program.
That's, like, stressful for high
school. it was very stressful. And I took film there because I knew I wanted to work in film. And then I went to the University of Colorado for a year.
Gotcha.
And then I didn't go there anymore.
Yeah, you were
I dropped out.
Here we go, Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And did you move straight to LA after that?
I did. I came here. I did not enjoy my year at that school. It just wasn't the right program for me.
But you were doing film there.
I was, but that school, it was a film studies program, so it wasn't production. So you couldn't check out equipment your freshman year. You basically, making films was not part of the program at all. So it was very, you know, Stan Brakhage, experimental film, you know, just
a lot of everything on your iPhone.
Oh, I wish iPhones had existed then. It was just like very, it was just much more clinical and, I, in a lot of ways, felt like I was paying to go to high school again because I was taking, like, biology and Spanish three. And,
a lot
you know.
Of general ed stuff.
Yeah. So it just wasn't for me. So I moved to L.A. and got a job. The Arclight had just opened, for those of you who know that theater.
What was
Los
your
Angeles.
Favorite movie on your name tag?
Oh, God. At the time, my favorite movie was Shawshank Redemption. Bold, out there choice. I know. Very strange. Immediately was like, why did I pick that? That's not, like, it's a great movie. I love that movie, but I don't know if it's my favorite movie. And then second-guessed it for the rest of my very
and
short
it's literally on your name tag the whole time.
And you know, it was such a novel thing. Everyone came up and was like, "What's on your name tag? What's in?" And just
And this is you said it's like right when they opened, right?
Yeah, so, 2002.
Okay, yeah. So like, just to kind of paint the picture, it was the first theater I had ever been to where you reserved your seats and like it was high, like very, it was an expensive ticket. It still is.
Yes.
It was like a very premium experience.
Yeah. Movie, most of why I went and got a job there was because I went and saw a movie. I was shocked at how expensive it was. And then I was blown away that they turned off all the lights in the movie theater. I was like, oh, they'd have no lights whatsoever. I wanted to go see movies there. I was broke. And so I was like, well, if I work here, I can see movies for free.
And
so
did you have to do the speech?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was an usher greeter. That was my job. I loved doing the speech. I would custom fit my speeches to match whatever movie I was doing.
Wait, so for those of our listeners that don't live in LA, what's the what is that speech about?
So at the beginning of every movie at Arclight, as part of their like boutique movie-going experience, they send a person out to introduce the movie. They kind of give, you know, you'll be here to watch whatever movie, please turn off your cell phones. I'll be standing off to the side to make sure the picture and sound is great. You know, it's just
up to ArcLight standards.
Yeah.
Have you ever, had you ever seen the picture and sound not up to standards and like done something about it?
Occasionally, yeah. I mean, I because I worked there when film still existed in the movie going experience, every once in a while there was like, you know, the, it jumped a sprocket and the alignment was off, or, you know, we did catch stuff every once in a while.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a method behind the madness at Arclight. Right. Yeah, yeah.
What I loved about it is I would go watch movies at the Grove, which is, like, where, like, high school kids go, and they would just be, like, texting the whole time, and it would be annoying, and I'd tell, like, an usher, and, like, nothing would happen, and then that
they'd
high
be like,
kid
I know,
would,
I'm texting my friend.
Me up after the movie.
Yeah, yeah. But that's the most movie-going
But
experience.
At the Arclight, they would do something about it.
Yeah.
They'd be like, excuse me, you.
And it was, like, $18 on a Saturday night, so, like, kids aren't dropping that sort of cash to go see a movie.
Yeah, it was a very well-to-do crowd.
Yeah, so. I mean, the Beverly Hills kids.
Sure, right, maybe. Yeah, the trust funders would come by and spend some coin, but, you know. But, yeah, it was a great job for someone interested in movies, so... I got to see everything.
And when did you transition from day jobs, Joe jobs, into directing? How did that happen?
Well, when I got out here, I just started basically working any job I could to be around it. So a lot of like Craigslist, like we need crew to come work on a student film and you get lunch and a copy of the movie and, you know, that type of stuff. I just jumped at whatever I could. I actually met a group of people at Arclight. We all worked there and we started making short films together and making, you know, projects together. And then we eventually did a feature together.
A feature?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And
yeah,
did you buy like a camera and editing equipment? Like, were you doing
it
all?
I did. Yeah. I bought a DVX-100, a Panasonic camera.
Sure. The first one to do 24p.
Yeah. So I was like really excited by the prospect of that. I saved up. I had had like a Handycam before that and a Sony VX-2000. And I was always working to buy more equipment. And then I edited on my Sony Vaio.
Which
I don't even remember the editing software.
Vegas?
It was either Vegas or Casablanca. I might have had Casablanca at the time.
Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah.
So I was just always making stuff on my own. And then, boom operator, grip, editor, whatever people needed. I was just volunteering for stuff all the time. So, you know, you meet a lot of people doing that.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So what was your first paid job?
I guess the first job I got hired to do, there was a company called Super Deluxe, for those who have been on the internet long enough to remember. It was a TBS-funded Adult Swim offshoot. And I met a comedian named Jonah Ray.
Oh, you did
working
his show.
At Arclight.
You did his show?
Yeah, we did a series for Super Deluxe called Jonah's The Freeloader's Guide to Easy Living.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I watched
that. And it was like super fun. We got to do whatever we wanted. They paid us an insanely small amount of money. But at the time, we were like, money to make stuff? That's
deal.
Holy crap.
Yeah. I already own the camera.
I think we probably spent way beyond our budget just making it and didn't even have money left over to like live on. But it still felt like we were like the kings of Hollywood.
Yeah, and it was Turner.
Yeah, right? There was like a degree of officialness. They made us sign paperwork mm-hmm. and stuff, and there were delivery specs, and it was like, wow, this is like real. And we made like, I think, 5 or 6 short films in this series, and then that just sort of started the ball a little bit of like mm-hmm. gig to gig. I DP'd a lot at that time. I did like it was supposed to be for TV, and then it was for web, but for Matt Besser, I DP'd like a web series thing for him.
Who's one of the founders of UCB.
Yeah, very talented improv comedian, weird guy, love him a lot. never remembered my name, probably wouldn't remember my name if I saw him today. Yeah, I've worked with him 100 times.
There is a weird thing about directing, especially when you're doing that level stuff, like the Midnight Show level videos where you're doing everything. You are like getting the script to the right place. You are shooting it. You're editing it. You're directing it. You're, you know, outputting it, making sure it looks right on the screen. Yeah. And then people don't know who you are.
Yeah.
And it's like,
you're like, I literally did all of this.
Yeah. I mean, I loved it because it was fun to work on stuff. The people were talented. I got to do like the Midnight Show, you know, to be around live screenings was mm-hmm. really fun. That was like a very unique kind of high for someone who usually was like uploading things to YouTube, like to hear actual people laugh at stuff. It was like great. So I loved being around it. But yeah, at the same time, there was definitely a degree of obscurity. They definitely took you for granted doing that stuff. And I was just like, yeah, it'd be cool to like do something for myself. So I was always kind of working on my own stuff on the side mm-hmm. when I was doing that stuff.
And you met Payman Benz through the Midnight Show, too,
I right? did. Much later. That was probably, not much later, but that was probably 2008, I want to say. Maybe 2007 is when I first met Payman. But yeah, I met a lot of great people through the Midnight Show, a lot of great directors that I still keep in touch with. And there was a really, I mean, at UCB in general, the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater in LA, there was just a great talent pool that just hung out and, mm-hmm. you know, you just met people and then...
It was like a mixture of, you know, people were spending money on internet videos mm-hmm. and like, oh, you could turn those into TV shows. Like there was a real promise of this being not just something that's fun and cool and maybe makes you a tiny bit famous, but also like it was a real investment in your careers.
Right.
And also the theater was still pretty new. And so it was this great mixture of like, the internet being the Wild West and just feeling that there was opportunity. There was something in the air back
then. Yeah. I liken it to the music video movement in the 80s. Like there was just enough money that people were kind of able to earn a living off of it, but you also had almost complete freedom because mm-hmm. people had no idea what they were doing and kind of didn't know what to ask of filmmakers.
And it was small enough money that like,
yeah, really the stakes cared. Were super low. Yeah. Nobody cared. And so I loved sketch because I just got to experiment with craft and technique and try mm-hmm. stuff. And you know, someone sends you a script and you're like, cool, can we do this in this style? And they're like, well, okay, I guess sure. if you want to do that, it seems like a pain in the ass. So, you know, but it was, yeah, I got to like make tons of weird stuff that I would never get to make.
And they kind of, they wouldn't make for TV at the time either.
No. Yeah. I mean, I think now we're so desensitized to it because so much is online that we're like, the line is blurred so much. But yeah, I mean, you know, people were constantly shocked at what you could get away with. And sure. so.
I was just thinking today about how when I was doing videos like back then, I was just so confident. And if someone said, like, go make this parody, I'd be like, oh, yeah, we can do that. We'll do this sure. and this and this. And
$2,000, no problem.
And perfect. Now yeah. I'll be on something with a bigger budget and a whole crew and everything. And I'm so stressed out. Like, I'm like, is that close up going to work? Like,
it's
about
really
nothing.
True.
How much more stressed and self-conscious I am now than I was when I was doing like these impossible things.
It's very true. Yeah. I mean, I look at even stuff I did on Key & Peele. I'm like, why did I think I could get away with that? But like, ignorance is bliss. And yeah, when no one's like telling you, sure. well, you have to, you know, it has to be done like this. It's like, yeah, okay. It's freedom.
Great.
It's great.
So I want to get into Key & Peele actually, but I just to clarify or just to connect the dots between The Midnight Show and Key & Peele. So you had done a few sketches with like Ian Roberts, right? Like who was mm-hmm. another UCB founder and the executive producer of Key & Peele along mm-hmm. with Jay Martell, right? And Keegan and Jordan, obviously. And so how did that, and you directed up until the last season, literally every single sketch of Key & Peele. So how did that happen? What prepared you to be ready to like helm such a big undertaking?
And did wasn't ready.
Did it start as a TV show or was it like a digital show?
It was so TV from the beginning. So Keegan and Jordan met on Mad TV. They were friends and they did sketches together, but they weren't like partners. And they had the same manager, and their manager, after Mad TV was over, was like, hey, you guys should go sell a sketch show together. You guys did great sketches together on that show. And they kind of started meeting and working together. And they were like, yeah, there's good chemistry here. We should do something. And they sold it. They originally sold the pitch. The pitch was them doing live sketches. This was before I ever got in, like in the room with the executives. They did like three sketches. Mm-hmm. And it sold to Fox and to Comedy Central. And they had to kind of decide where they wanted to go.
Oh, interesting.
And,
Fox, like network TV.
Network TV. They were going to make a primetime sketch show based around Keegan and Jordan. They wanted it to be like a new In Living Color. But they had all these stipulations, and they had had a history because of their experience on Mad TV of kind of knowing what that world was like. And so they chose the more creatively free path of going to Comedy Central. And then they started meeting with directors. And so about 3 years before that happened, I had done, which tells you how old it was, a MySpace web pilot with Keegan that was terrible, but fun. And we stayed in touch and hung out from time to time. And so when they were putting together the pilot, he knew, you know, because we had worked together on that and he had seen some of my other work and was kind of a fan, and Ian had worked with me on Midnight Show. So there was like enough work for me to get in the door. And that was how I met Jordan. Mm-hmm. And I had a meeting with Keegan, Jordan, Ian, and Jay, and we just hit it off. It was just like my whole pitch to them was I wanted to make a sketch show where every sketch felt like the funniest set piece in a movie or in a show or in just a world. And it's been like lifted out. And you get the context from the beginning of the sketches and the mood and the style and the music and all of the clues that aren't like in the dialogue. Because I hated in sketch how so often it just starts with this like naked exposition.
Yeah,
and it's
sure.
Like, ugh.
Here we are as two teenagers going to high school.
Yeah, it's just, it has to be on the nose. And so that's kind of a symptom of stage sketch where like you have to paint that picture. Mm-hmm. And so we really wanted to do it a different way and sort of use filmmaking as a way to lay that groundwork. And they loved that idea. And they were like, yeah, that sounds perfect. We want to do it. And so they sent me to Comedy Central to meet with our network execs, Jim Sharp, Gary Mann, and Monica, who's lovely. We love her. And they were like, really nice to meet you. You seem great. You're 20. I think at that time I was 27. They were like, you seem like a really nice person. There's no way we're letting you direct a show for television. Cause I had one TV credit or two. I did Web Soup sketches and I did a pilot for Adult Swim. And it was like, yeah, thanks for coming in. No, thank you. And they hired someone else. And
the story gets good here. I didn't know about this.
Yeah, this is the untold. And so they prepared to start with that director. And I think 2 or 3 weeks before the pilot started shooting, he dropped out. I think he decided, I don't want to speculate too much, but I feel like he decided it was too much of the same thing for him. Mm-hmm. He had done shows like that in the past.
Wasn't the right fit. Yeah.
And he left, and I was still available because I was living in a shitty studio apartment in Hollywood. And I was like, hey, I'm still down. And they kind of had no options at that point. So
wow.
I got the job very last minute.
How did
in.
You find out that the job was open again?
I didn't even have, I don't think he was my manager officially at that point. But Peter Principato, who is today my manager, he had sort of brought me in at one point and was like, hey, I don't want to represent you, but I'll recommend you to my clients for stuff. And I was like, okay, cool. And he called me and he's like, hey, Key & Peele just became open again. And I think they're going to go for you. And I was just ecstatic. I was over the moon. And that job, I mean, that pilot was still one of the most fun things I've ever worked on. It was just like magic.
And you hit it out of the park.
Well, thanks. But, right. I mean,
a lot of that went to air, right? Like I said, bitch.
Yeah, it all. The whole thing.
The whole thing. Yeah.
So the only thing we reshot was the live studio audience wraparounds. Because the whole concept at the beginning on the pilot, which I found a copy of not that long ago, it was kind of amazing, was we wanted it to feel like you were walking in New York City and you heard some laughter coming from these basement stairs, and you go down the stairs and you're in a tiny club in Greenwich Village, mm-hmm. and there's a comedy show happening and these two guys are on stage and they're just like electric. So we shot it like that, and the network was like, what the fuck are you doing?
Sure,
yeah, swear.
Sorry,
yeah.
I never know. But like, what are you doing? That looks terrible. So they were like, we're going to bring in somebody who does this professionally, because mm-hmm. I was not a live sure. tape person. And the way it works in variety shows is the person who directs the live audience segment gets the directed by credit.
What?
It's an archaic DGA rule. I've lobbied for years to change it. It's super annoying, but it's because most variety shows are like late night shows where mm-hmm. that right. is most of the show. And then you have field pieces and you throw to that. But it saves the network's money if they classify them as variety shows, because the pay structure is differently. So it's still a variety show, even if you're more sketches than live audience. So they wanted to bring in a director. And I did, after the pilot, I did a whole deep dive into directing those uh-huh. types of shows. I watched every comedy special and sketch show. I did a PowerPoint presentation. And I went in and did this whole presentation to Ken Alterman, the head of the network, of like, here's why I should direct the live audience mm-hmm. stuff, and here's how we would do it, and we'd totally change it. We'd do it in a big theater and make it glossy, and they stupidly went for it. So that was how I ended up being able to direct everything on the show and direct
wow.
both pieces.
That's awesome. I mean, I think just the like one takeaway is just, it doesn't matter, like, if people say no to you, you know, you kind of, yeah. not you. I mean, I think.
No, it's stubbornness can be an asset. It can also get you into a lot of trouble, but yeah.
Right. Everyone wanted you for the job, and then they didn't hire you, and then somehow you got it, you know, and then everybody, you know, wanted you for the next job and they didn't hire you, and somehow you convinced yeah. them to get you, to
there's
hire
an,
you.
There's an alternate reality where, like, you were like, well, I guess that's it.
Yeah, I mean, you know they, I mean? They wanted to have multiple yeah. directors, and then somebody else directs sure. a live audience. And
which
I
is traditional. That's what most sketch yeah. shows do that. Like yeah. even Comedy Central shows, right? Like yeah. Schumer has like a ton of different directors, right? Like
mostly Ryan McFall, though. I will say that was really okay. Ryan's baby, especially the first season, especially. But
gotcha.
The
okay.
first two seasons, he did most of them.
Because like Neil Brennan did a couple episodes.
Yeah.
And, like,
yeah they eventually had, and Amy started directing and, yeah. you know, so they opened it up quite a bit. But yeah, I mean, I had such a fun experience on the pilot and so fell in love with the show that I was just, I just wanted to direct every part of it, and also was very protective of it mm-hmm. because I knew kind of what it could be and just how talented those guys are. I mean, they're really amazing performers.
Yeah.
So when you direct a pilot for Comedy Central, do you get paid for every episode that airs after that?
No. That's part of that DGA rule.
Oh, the variety
show. So the variety show, they don't pay directors residuals. So normally on a pilot, yes, you get a royalty fee for every episode that airs because you've established the look. You also get residuals every time a rerun airs. None of that happens on variety shows. Variety shows, they're treated as it airs once, and if it airs again, you don't get residuals because it's a variety show, and they're probably making 300 of them a year.
Well, what about EP credit? Do you get that?
I did not. So because I was so young and badly needed the job, they knew that they did not have to give me that. So I had to, I think the first season I had no producing credit. Second season, I negotiated for co-producer, and then I think season three on was when I finally got an EP credit. Mm-hmm. But that took a lot of negotiation.
Does that credit give you more power, like in terms of like making decisions on who's the DP is going to be, or
it
like how many
does.
Episodes?
I mean, that was a really unique show because I came in as a director on the pilot. Helped establish the show, was involved in all those decisions. And then the traditional model on TV is you have rotating directors, the showrunners run the show, and that's kind of it. And they're like, thank you so much, goodbye. And I just kept showing up and kept being like, hey, can I be in on that meeting too? Because I kind of care about what the marketing is. And like, hey, I have some feedback on the crew and I'd like to, you know, help us make sure we are bringing back the right people. And so I just kind of kept inserting myself into those conversations because, one, I didn't really know any better, and two, I really cared about the show and I wanted everything to be as good as it could possibly be. And so they sort of begrudgingly let me into that process the first season. And then after the first season, I was just in. And
I think there's also a thing of, like, if you're a part of all those conversations and the authority, people just start asking you questions and then it's no one's true. Questioning it.
You know? I mean, I will say Jay and Ian are fantastic writers they are amazing at running a writer's room and running a writer's team. They're not the most savvy on production, or they weren't at that time. And so they were very happy to kind of let me run the production side and let me manage the post side.
Because, their jobs are hard.
Yeah, they had tons to do. And I had a lot of technical knowledge and I had a willingness to do it. It wasn't part of my job description. I wasn't getting paid for it the first couple of seasons, but I had a vested interest in making sure every piece was done to a certain level. And I enjoy every step of the process. I love being at sound mixes. I love being at color sessions. I love the whole thing.
But how did you know how to run post on a TV show that's on cable TV without ever having done it?
Oh, I knew post because I had been an editor. I hadn't been an editor on a TV show, but I had edited so much of my own stuff and I had delivered web series, which by that point where you did have to deliver them to network standards, you had to output to tape, you had to know deliverables. So I love learning about it. So I had already soaked up a lot of knowledge. And then the places where I didn't have a lot of knowledge, I just asked questions. I wasn't afraid to be like, why are we doing that? What's that for? What's an M&E? What's a CTM?
What is an M&E and what is a CTM?
An M&E is music and effects. Mm-hmm. It's a track so that they can do language dubbing for international delivery and bleeping. And then a CTM is a color time master. It's what you deliver your final colored version of the show, whether it's a file or a tape.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So, yeah. I just kind of kept sticking my finger in a lot of pies. I mean, it was just... And sometimes people would get a little like, why do you want to know, or why do you want to be involved in that? And it always came from a good place of like, I just want to make sure it's really good and we're doing everything we can to make it better. And
like no one cares as much as you do, basically, right?
I try to outcare people as much as possible. It's a good way of wearing people down and getting what you want.
Yeah. So around this point, I had been working at Comedy Central basically as you had been doing all of this Key and Peele work. And I remember I'd bounced around a lot. And I remember like running the YouTube page at that point and being like, what the fuck is going on? Right. Because no one really was caring about the page very much.
They
at that point.
Hated YouTube at the first season.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, definitely.
The pilot, they didn't even want to put sketches online, full sketches. They wanted truncated short versions of the sketches.
I mean, that makes complete sense because culturally they didn't really have a page to begin with because Viacom had been in a huge lawsuit.
They still were at that point.
Yeah, totally.
They were, I think, until season 3 or maybe even 4.
And literally for $1 billion we're talking about, right?
With YouTube.
Yeah.
And
it was
literally a lawsuit that they knew they couldn't win. It was like the principle of the thing lawsuit. And because they were so old media, they were just like, we have to do this for the sake of IP and for the sake of, and I mean, everyone lost that fight eventually on the television.
The fight I would argue,
except for Key and Peele, because actually, you guys were the first show that really got to put their stuff up on YouTube once it had kind of like grown a little bit.
We fought tooth and nail for that. That was kind of because I had come from the world of internet comedy and had things go viral. I knew the power of what that could do. And nobody, there was eventually one person at the network, an executive named Tara Schuster, who's in development now. And she was sort of the other person who was like, yes, we have to get stuff on YouTube. It's very important for not just the show, but the network as a whole to reach a new audience.
Yeah, absolutely. So while all that stuff was happening, that's when Substitute Teacher blows up, you know, like, and then it became like a ritual of like every single week. What are the new sketches?
Yeah.
And I had been writing and directing basically in my free time that whole time. and had talked to Tara and was like, yo, I'm going to quit real soon. I really want to be a part of Key and Peele in some way. Like, can I shadow Peter? Like, what is going on? And that was around when Mike and Von Davion, the characters Keegan and Jordan, critique the show. They have their own YouTube show, and they critique all of the sketches and explain how basically they could be better if, like, a character...
They had dicks.
They had dicks. Yeah. Like, what if instead that was a dick? And cracking each other up.
Oh, yeah.
And so for the final season, I basically was on set as though Mike and Van Davion had been hired as PAs and were leaking footage online. So that last season, I got to, like, hang out.
It got real meta.
Yeah.
The whole Van Davion and Mike experience.
The last episode you were in, you fire.
That's right. I fire.
And Ian punches the camera operator, which is me.
That's right. That was the Rashida Jones sketch.
And she's like, what the fuck
is
going
on? Oh, hey, Rashida, we're going to also do this little behind the scenes thing. Jordan's going to pretend to be this really annoying guy. Just go with it. Or no, Keegan was going to pretend to be the annoying guy.
Jordan
got pissed off. And then I threw him off set. And then, Ian punched the camera.
Yeah, that's right. Good times.
Yeah. Oh, Van Davion and Mike, yeah. Emmy-nominated web series.
Sure, that is true. Davion and Mike. That's true. The Ascension.
Yeah.
But so I think it's a rare opportunity to be, like, watching someone direct basically for that whole season. I was there most of the time.
Yeah.
And also Payman had been, like, hanging out as well, and we'd known each other because of all of the Adam Film stuff. And I think we both had that experience of, like, watching you be like, hey, we need to fix this, and then, like, people doing it. Right? And we were like, what the fuck is going on? Peter just said he, like, wanted to change something, and then six dudes did it.
I did have a very outsized amount of responsibility and power on that show that I did not appreciate at the time until I did more television.
So talk about that, actually.
Well,
because you were the king of the kingdom in a lot of ways, right?
Well, I just, there was a lot of trust. It was a matter of trust. I, demonstrated having good taste and good instincts. And so generally speaking, if I spoke up, it was because I really had a thought, and sometimes it made it better and sometimes it didn't. Sure. And that's the process. But Keegan and Jordan were very inclusive, very trusting. Jay and Ian were very inclusive, very trusting. And so I just, I was involved in every aspect of that show. Sure. And then on set, they started treating me like another writer EP who was on set pitching ideas and suggestions and stuff. And it was just super fun. I liken it to, they were the two best jazz musicians in the world. And occasionally I got to like play the drums for a song. Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, it was a really fun experience. And then going to do particularly other episodic where you're sort of the asshole of the week, and depending on the show, they may not give a shit what you think or what you want. And you're there as a blocking, consultant.
Yeah, sure.
I tried to avoid those experiences, but at the same time, it was definitely hard for me to realize, like, oh, if I don't like something, I can't make them change it. I really took that for granted.
And not only that, but, like, you're doing the same style over and over again.
Yeah.
Like, literally with Key and Peele, it would be the first half of the day you do one crazy stylized sketch, and then the second half of the day would be something utterly different.
Yeah. We did two sketches a day every day. We moved. We were on location every day. It was in a lot of ways a filmmaking boot camp, because it was grueling, but we also got to do everything. My first AD would always joke, like, you're going to have the best reel coming out of this show because it'll look like you've done everything.
Yeah.
And all you've done is this show. And I was like, yeah,
cool.
That's what I'm going for.
The same two actors in every scene.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Well, I'm curious, it might be hard to answer this simply, but like, what did you learn about getting comedy to work on that show? Like, what were some of the lessons?
So much. I mean, I think the biggest like headline lesson was just the meritocracy of laughter. Like, mm-hmm. you can argue with something, but if it makes people laugh, it's funny. And that was the rule on our show. If it made us laugh, it won. It was truly a meritocracy of comedy.
And I don't know if you realize this, but in blocking rehearsals, the crew would laugh.
Yeah.
And that's pretty rare.
And Keegan and Jordan would, and especially Keegan, would feed off of that, mm-hmm, you know.
Sure.
But it was very instinctual, but at the same time, all of the little rules, you know, it's great to have a tag for a scene. Those guys taught me more about comedic improv than any class I'm sure I could have ever taken, just because they always did it from a place of truth to those characters, whichever characters they were playing. Mm-hmm. So it was an incredibly valuable comedy experience that I find myself drawing on without even realizing it now. Like, you can just tell now when you're hearing something out loud or seeing it performed, like, oh, we need to punch that up. It's a little soft there. It's a little weak here. This is where it's really shining. A little bit more back and forth would be good. He's too low status. You know, all of those little, like, oh, we can just juice it a little bit and tweak it. And then at the same time, the power and importance of showing stuff to an audience, getting an honest audience feedback who are not invested in it, because you fall in love with something and you protect it, and then you watch it and it just dies in an audience and you're like, oh yeah, I guess that cool shot isn't doing a whole lot
right. That
I was trying to protect. So a lot of really valuable lessons came out of that show.
Well, how did you deal with, sorry, Matt, that I'm talking on our podcast. how did you like balance the genre stuff, like a horror film or an action film, with the comedy? Mm-hmm. Like, how did those things not fight against each other?
They did constantly. And I will say too, the genius of Keegan and Jordan, I was always on the more genre, more style, more, you know, more drama side of the equation. And Jay and Ian were usually on the extreme other side of, like, who cares, as long as it's funny, like, get to the joke. And Keegan and Jordan really straddled those two instincts, and in different ways. Like, I think Keegan probably leaned a little bit more towards the, if it's funny, that's all that matters. And Jordan was a little bit more like, no, but it's cool to be the show that, like, mm-hmm. can spend a minute just being dramatic and cool, and then it's funny. So there was always a give and a take, but I think my instincts about that got better and better as the show went on. Like, I got less precious. At the beginning, I was so like, well, this is how they would do it in the action movie, so we have to do that. And it was like, no, you don't. People get it. You show them like 12 seconds of that and they're like, yeah, I get it. I know where I am. And so I'm less precious about that stuff now, but it still taught me the value of caring about that, especially with comedy, which, mm-hmm. I mean, more often than not, people don't care about that stuff. So right. It's nice when they do.
And do you find now, kind of in your current career, right, because you did the, well, help me out, JCVJ, there we go.
Yeah.
and also this new show that's just coming out, the
Whiskey Cavalier.
Whiskey Cavalier, which are both kind of like stylized action comedies, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You have to assume that, like, your reel from Key and Peele basically is what helped you kind of transition into stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. It's varies job to job. Yeah. I will say Key and Peele is the one thing that no matter who I'm meeting with, they know what it is, and they usually have like a fond mm-hmm. emotional connection with that, like whether they've seen one sketch online that their son-in-law sent them
right. Or.
They loved the show and watched it religiously. So that definitely helps open doors. But I've always been interested in moving more into dramatic storytelling, or, you know, stuff that isn't just comedy. And so for me, the more comfortable I get in that world, the more I just find myself leaning into that and, mm-hmm. and moving in that direction. And it's also just what seems like it'll be challenging. I'm always drawn to that.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I feel like the three of us all kind of like came up in the internet, right?
Yeah.
And so you kind of need to do comedy. That's kind of the only choice. It's not like there were that you could be like directing plays and then pop from that or something. I suppose you could, but like that wasn't the path right then.
It
was, the obvious choice was like, I love comedy and I also love drama, but Funny or Die just started. You know what I mean?
Yeah, especially in like that viral video world, you either have like a real thing, right? A moving story, a funny baby, a dog farting, whatever. Or you have something that's an amazing parody or just super funny. Right.
Yeah. I think the benefit of when I got started and when a lot of people I know got started was it was early enough that you could still get noticed with style. I think that's less and less now just because so many people are so good at that now that it's really hard to stand out. Like, I can't imagine.
Take a look at a Vimeo staff pick.
Man, right? Just like, going into YouTube comedy nowadays, I mean, there are people who make millions of dollars off YouTube alone and put tons of money into production resources, and it's just a different
ballgame. My guilty pleasure is like when I see an article that's like, Mike J, YouTuber with 10 million subscribers, has officially said he's burnt out and taking a break from YouTube. I'm like, see, it's like freaking hard to just be making amazing YouTube videos.
It's a grind.
He's still streaming on Twitch, though.
Good for Mike.
His Overwatch videos are so dope, though. But to finish my point, I wonder if now we're going to see people who had that early start in comedy diverging and going into, like, now that they've got, like, feature careers and, like...
Definitely. That's already... I mean, Jordan Voight Roberts, you know...
Oh, interesting. Like, good point. Yeah.
I absolutely started in internet comedy.
We should have Jordan.
Jordan Peele. Sure. So, a little small success story. I think he's going to be okay. I worry about him. Yeah. I think that's happening more and more. I know there are other good examples that I'm not thinking of, but... It's interesting. It was definitely the world I came up in my path, but also as I get to know more filmmakers, I see how many different paths there are, and there's really no right way of doing anything, I feel like.
There's hope for our listeners yet.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's just do what excites you and what interests you, and don't be afraid to fail over and over again.
Killer. Because you bounce back and forth a little bit between commercials as well, which I think is on the like unique side, right? Like, we were talking about that Pepsi like prank video from years ago now.
Yeah, that's jobs like that are why I still do commercials.
Sure.
Like, every once in a while, you get to do something that is totally weird or bizarre or insane. And you get paid really well for it. So that's like the perfect harmony of, but then that's offset by like more often, 9 times out of 10, it's like pretty mind numbing and you kind of hate every moment of it. So
sure. I will say
it's a balance.
From my experience in the commercial world, I'd say like 80% of my jobs I've been on, the agency has referred to Key and Peele's sketch.
Oh,
like,
really?
Yeah. People are always saying, like, you know, the one where they're like saying the football names or whatever. Yeah. It's like, we want it to be just like that. I'm like, okay. Well,
you should tweet to Keegan.
Why are you using non-union actors for starters?
Yeah.
They're not going to be as funny.
It can be very soul crushing. You know, like when you're 20 emails deep in a thread about people arguing about what the curtains in the background should be. And you're like, guys, I don't care. Yeah. I know you're like paying me to pretend to care, but I can't anymore. I can't pretend.
Have you ever had people tell you like, you know, here's the concept, but we just, you know, we want you to plus it, like give us something, throw us some
every
ideas.
Every time, which like, okay, pay me as a writer in addition to directing, like, you know, and yeah, it's the comedy commercials is, a very distinct and unique and kind of special hellhole these days because everyone wants it like to be shareable and viral. Sure. And we want to shoot some like bonus content to share on social. And it's like,
and make sure it works vertical.
It's a grim and meanwhile, the budgets are going down and down and down. So it's just kind of a strange time in commercials right now.
I feel especially bad for actors who are expected to improvise and make bad copy better.
Yeah.
That's especially crappy.
Yeah.
And then you never have time to improvise either.
No, right? it's such a, all of the things, they send you like 2 days before the shoot, just a crazy list of alts. They're like, here's the alts we'd love to get. I'm like, guys, you see the shot list, you see how many hours we have, you wouldn't pay for a second day. I mean, maybe. Yeah. I mean, what I have found and what I have gotten more comfortable with is I feel like in the ad world, sometimes, not always, but sometimes the more of a dick you are, the more they respect you and
yeah,
you
they like it
thing.
A little bit.
They
yeah.
love it. They're like, yeah, be mean to us. I'm like, no, I'm not. Yeah, that's like,
he's a real Don Draper type.
They're just like, wow, okay. If you just tell them no, they're so not used to hearing that they're kind of like, oh, okay, yeah.
How do you deal with that? I mean, I'm curious from both of you guys, when people are telling you to shoot way more than you have time to shoot, like what do you do?
Yeah.
My favorite phrase is that I picked up from a producer. I worked with a producer on Jean-Claude Van Johnson. Was there is a physics to filmmaking. And like anytime people's requests get outlandish, you just go, guys, there is a physics to this. I am telling you what we have time for. This is what we can do. If we have extra time, we can do this, but there's no way we're going to get to what you're asking for. And generally, as soon as you make it like math is mm-hmm. saying they can't have it, they're kind of like, oh, okay, yeah.
Sure.
Oh, well, then we'll have to figure it out. I mean, sometimes they don't. I've been on jobs. I did a campaign for a social media network last year, and the head creative was, a very nice guy, but also very in love with his own creativity and his own ideas
sure.
and wasn't willing to accept reality. And so I was like, I can get that for you, but it's going to compromise this.
Yeah.
No, it's going to be okay. We're going to make it. And then
we'll go over.
We didn't get that shot.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, but sometimes like there's a physics and the sun is going down. And if you want me to get this, guys, we're not going to get the last shot.
Sometimes I do this thing and I don't think it works, but I'll be like, how many minutes do you think it's going to take us to get this? Do you think we could shoot that in 3 minutes? Do you think we can like roll the cameras, make sure sound's rolling and do all that in 3 minutes? If you do, we'll try it. I'll give you 3 minutes, but it's really going to take 30 minutes.
The problem for me too, and this is part of what I've had to learn to deal with, I'm eternally an optimist when it comes to that. So mm-hmm. I'm always like, yeah, you know what? Let's try to get it. We can do that. And then you like, as you're spending your, 10 minutes blocking the background to just walk forward on cue, you're like, oh, right. Everything takes a really long time in this job. And we're not going
to
get it.
And you're ready. And then your lead actor needs to go to the restroom. And you're like, come on.
Yeah.
Really?
I had an AD once tell me that it just takes 5 minutes to put your pants on. And he's like, yeah, it does. It's just like you got to go to you go to your trailer, you change out, blah, 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 blah. You walk back and it's like, oh, yeah, it's 5 minutes. So like no matter what.
Oh, yeah.
Like that's the smallest amount of time that anything takes, basically.
Yeah. And then there's the actors who just have no concept of time, and putting on their pants takes them an hour.
Sure.
Or they decide to take
a
shower.
Yeah.
That's
why
I do no pants on all of my sets.
No pants. That's good.
The two best people to talk shit with on a set are always the costumer and the hair and makeup people. And the costumer will always tell you who didn't wear underwear to set.
There's always
I've
one.
I've never had that conversation.
There's always one.
Talk to Bramley about it.
I will.
Yeah.
So you did a movie, right? Well, so is JCVJ a movie?
No, kind of. Sort of.
It feels like
We kind of backdoored like a 3-hour movie into Amazon. It's a series. It's a 6 half-hour episodes that tell a complete story.
Jean-Claude Van Damme.
It's a story of self-reflection and self-discovery in the mind of Jean-Claude Van Damme, but in the form of a show set in a world where the world's biggest movie stars are also undercover black ops agents. Mm-hmm. He plays himself as a washed-up former martial arts action hero who comes out of retirement who's, he's secretly an undercover secret agent, and he comes out of retirement both as an actor and as a, operative in the field in order to win back his former hairstylist who he thinks he's still in love with. And insanity ensues from there. It's the most bizarre thing I've ever worked on, and I love it like a child.
That sounds awesome. To me. Did you find out if that Volkswagen spot he did was real?
Which the Volvo one? The
Volvo,
splits?
Yeah, where he does the splits on the front.
It's real in that he really did the splits. There was a safety harness that they painted out.
Oh, okay.
But he is doing the splits over 2 trucks that were
moving.
Robotically controlled on a moving.
They're robotically controlled.
So I mean it's still impressive. It's just they
very
didn't
real.
Allow for the possibility risk. That he would fall in between and die.
Right.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Frankly, that's more real than I was anticipating.
Yeah. Yeah.
It would have been fine.
It's almost Tom Cruise real.
I mean, there's Tom Cruise is more real than real. I feel like he's operating as like a Thetan superhero.
But he's still like tied into something. They're still painting stuff out.
Tom Cruise?
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes. I feel like Tom Cruise, I did talk to an AD. We shot part of Whiskey Cavalier in Paris, and the first AD I had was the first AD on Mission Impossible, and he, on the new one, whatever it's called.
Yeah, yeah. The one he got super hurt
Rogue
on, right?
Rogue Alpha. Yeah. Yeah, and he said that like the risks that Tom Cruise takes sometimes cross into like stupid and dangerous and unsafe, and he left that show because was not comfortable.
Right,
because
the AD
with
it. Is
yeah, that's
it's
a
their
safety
responsibility.
Officer. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, you know, good for him that he's doing amazing stuff, but there are people whose like livelihoods depend on you not getting hurt. So
sure,
don't get hurt. Do it safe.
Right. Yeah. Well, so where I was going with the feature thing, so you did that movie Keanu, right? Mm-hmm. And you have obviously some of like the world's best improvisers in that movie. How much of a movie like that is improvised?
Not a lot. The biggest issue on that movie was time. We did not have enough time. And we had the same, roughly the same kind of time we would have had to make our show, but we had it, we were doing it in New Orleans with the New Orleans crew, which I didn't know moves at about 50% of the speed of an LA crew.
Right.
So we were just 50%. Always, I mean, it was crazy. I was, that was a very difficult experience for me. It taught me a lot of great lessons. That is a movie I cannot watch. I have not watched it since it came out. Cannot watch it. Too painful. So yeah, I mean, that movie, it was a brutal experience. So I would have probably liked to have done a little bit of more improv. And I would let the guys improv, but in very targeted, we called it targeted improv. So it was, we have a saying, this takes a 5K, it's a fun run.
Sure.
So when you do a 5K, it's like, just let it roll, let's see where it goes. And they would always keep it within the scene. So they were never just like fully discovering a scene. Like sometimes on Key & Peele, we'd come on and do a sketch and it was like, not working, let's redo it. And it would just completely change and we would improv the whole thing. That didn't happen on Keanu, but in scenes where it's the two of them and they're in a situation that allows for it, yeah, there's some improv in there, but not as much as you might think.
Yeah. What are some of the takeaways that you walked away with off of Keanu, besides like the pain and heartache?
Prep. You cannot prep enough. I've never ever felt prepped enough, but that was a movie where I really got my ass handed to me because I didn't prep as much as I should have.
How many weeks do you get to prep? Because that's a studio film, right?
It is. It was, yeah.
I remember seeing billboards.
It was a studio film that was run like an indie movie and then marketed like a studio film. So it's like the worst of possible combinations. I had 5 weeks of prep in New Orleans. And it was coming at a time that we were overlapping it with the last season of the show. So I was doing double duty with finishing the season 5 sketches and then also trying to prep. And then I went down to New Orleans and it was a crew I had never worked with before. And then I just didn't prep hard enough. I mean, I really got my ass handed to me because I learned the value of planning for the best but preparing the worst. And I just planned for like what I thought I was going to get in terms of number of setups per day and what I thought we'd be able to do. And the reality every day just kicked my ass. There wasn't a day on that movie where I didn't walk away going like, fuck, I don't know if I got that, what out of that scene, what I needed to get out of that scene. And, so that experience coupled with the studio post experience was pretty brutal. And you know, post is always you just being confronted with your own failures and shortcomings and trying to make the best of it. On that movie, it was a even more brutal process just because I didn't know that on studio movies, they don't really care about the script because in their mind, anything can happen in post. Post is just an infinite world of possibilities. You can change anything. Everything can be fixed with ADR, with new dialogue off camera, which I hate. So like you're on someone's back and they're saying something they're clearly not saying. So it was just, you know, a lot of notes that you get in post on that process where it's like, oh guys, if you had said that during the script phase, we wouldn't have this issue. Why are you giving that note now? That's not an editorial note. That's a script note.
Right.
And then that coupled with, make sure that the movie you're making is, that you think you're making is the movie that they're expecting you to make. There was a big disparity in that on that movie. We were making sort of this musing on action comedy and sort of a genre undermining of action comedy coupled with like exploring masculine identity. And we wanted to make that a deeper, darker movie. The pitch was always like, what if Michael Mann made a movie about guys pretending to be gangsters in LA? And the studio wanted a broad comedy that they could market to black people. Mm-hmm. And so that was not what the first cut was. Yeah. So there was a lot of back and forth and testing, and it was always very harmonious. It didn't ever get ugly with them, but it was still a very difficult process for sure.
Well, so on a studio film, when you're on set, are they like watching the dailies every day and like making sure you get the number of setups you said you're going to get?
No, what they do watch is they watch how many hours you're shooting. I shoot a lot. Mm-hmm. I always have. I like to shoot a lot.
You mean like you keep the camera rolling or you have
a lot of
cameras?
Both keeping it rolling. I like shooting two cameras. I like getting a fair number of setups. And on a movie like that too, like there's enough improvising and, you know, our style was to just kind of like keep rolling. It's digital. Who cares? Like reset. Right. Let's go again.
Go to Best Buy and buy another hard drive.
I got a talking to from the head of post after day one of like, you shot 5 hours yesterday. Nobody shoots 5 hours. Like, you're crazy. You have to keep it to 3.5 hours. And I was like, it's digital. Who cares? And they're like, no. So I got that talking to, which made me think, oh, they're watching every dailies like a hawk. And no, all they cared about was, is it bright enough? The only note we ever got was, that looks a little dark yesterday. We were in New Orleans, so there was no executives there. So we were very left alone to our own devices. So there's kind of this illusion of like, oh, they're letting us make the movie that we want to make. And then in post, they're like, oh, that's the movie you made? Cute. Here's what marketing has notes on. Marketing thinks this needs to be shorter. And I'm like, marketing's giving notes? It's like, oh, yeah. Yeah, we have to sell this movie. We're going to put like $30 million into the marketing. So it's like, oh, right. Yeah, that makes sense.
It's weird that marketing cares about the length of the movie because their job is done by the time you're seeing the movie, right?
That's, believe me, I said that in a lot of meetings and got death stares. It's like, it's a movie. They're not going to flip the channel. And they're just like, that's not what we're talking about at all, Peter. And like the opening is slow. I'm like, yeah, what you said, like, if they're there, they're going to watch the opening and they're going to enjoy, you know, but no, that is not the case at all, especially with comedy. I think with comedy, there's less of a, well, the director really cares about this. It's like, it didn't get a laugh for 3 minutes. What is happening? It's like, oh, they're not supposed to laugh here. They're supposed to be scared. And it's
right.
You're making a comedy. What are you doing? So there was a lot of, I mean, everything, music wasn't ever funny enough. Everything. I mean, it was, yeah.
And I'm sure you've gotten this question a zillion times, so I apologize. But like, is Keanu Reeves in on the name of the movie?
He's in the movie. He's the voice of Keanu. He's the voice of the cat.
Just for like a little.
For a dream sequence.
I saw the movie.
It doesn't, believe me, you're not the only one who didn't realize. It turns out when Keanu Reeves isn't being his Bill and Ted character, you don't know that it's Keanu Reeves. He does not have a distinctive way of speaking unless he's acting like he's stoned. So we put him, that was in post, Warner Brothers said, New Line said, we want the dream sequence to be bigger and funnier and have more.
Oh.
So we shot the George Michael video as pickups after we were back in LA, and we added the dream sequence with the cat. And then the head of the studio was like, hey, we should get Keanu Reeves to be the cat. And we hated that idea. And then he's the voice of the cat and they called in a favor and God only knows what they probably paid him. He was very nice. But yeah, nobody knows that it's Keanu Reeves. Like it's not.
He could have been a guy.
I mean, he doesn't
Which maybe would be illegal, I wonder.
It was a gray area. Yeah. I mean, we had a Benedict Cumberbatch joke in there at one point and they had to get permission from him. So they're very protective of famous people.
And he's clearly named after Keanu Reeves.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, he didn't know about the movie until actually at that point, the trailer had already come out.
Oh,
so
really?
he learned about it. His sister sent, actually, yeah, I screwed up that story. His sister sent him the trailer and said, I think you would dig this. And he loved the trailer. And he reached out and said, if there's anything I can do, let me know.
Oh, that's cool.
And then
awesome.
Toby Emmerich was like, yeah, we want you to be in this movie. And then they wanted him to do the Bill and Ted voice. And he and I talked about it. And he was like, I do not want to do that.
Yeah,
I was like,
yeah.
Don't do it. It's fine. And then he probably should have done it. So.
That reminds me, these three groundlings, they did this David Blaine videos that went kind of viral.
Sure, it was
like amazing Mike Day, videos, yeah.
Mitch Silpa and one other one that I forget, but they were so good. Yeah, right. And yeah. Mitch Silpa played David Blaine, and they were just making fun of David Blaine. And David Blaine loved the videos so much, he like reached out to them and was like, "Hey, you guys want me to do the next one?" And they're like, "Oh, that's so awesome! We'll figure it out. We'll get back to you." And Mitch was like, we just thought about it forever and we just couldn't figure out a way where it's
not
funny with
yeah.
the real David Blaine. So they're like, thanks, really but no thanks.
Oh, man.
You could play it.
I kind of wish that had happened. That would have been, but they're probably right. That probably, yeah.
Yeah, it's like
yeah,
that.
It's just, thing. Yeah.
So what's your deal now? I mean, I see your name everywhere. Like,
you
I know
do?
Your work. I've watched a lot of Last Man. I watched the whole all of Last Man on Earth.
Oh, nice, nice.
I saw your
Rest
name
in peace.
There a lot.
Pour a little out.
And is yeah, that was a, did you do Brooklyn Nine-Nine also?
I did not. I met on that show. I love the people who work on that show. That show was not a good fit for me as a director.
Yeah.
I met on a lot of shows where I called my agent afterward and I was like, I don't want to do it. And he's like, what are you talking about? Like, why, what are you, I got you that meeting so you could do an episode. And I was like, no, I don't want to do it. But that's a show where, they cross shoot everything. It's all handheld. Their DP calls it the bim bam boom is how he does every scene is three setups and you knock it out and everyone's home by 4 or 5. And
I shadowed on that show. Most scenes are one setup.
Yeah. So it was just not for me.
It's a cool way to make a show, just to clarify.
Totally.
But yeah, it's a different.
I would love to, if I was working on a show like that and I got to see my kid every night,
yeah,
I would
sure.
be super grateful. And that's, you know, I there's definitely a place for that. It was not a place where I would thrive. Yeah. So
do you have like a philosophy on like how you choose your jobs, especially when it's like more of a director for hire type of thing?
Nowadays it's to say no. No, that's not true. It just, I go in and meet with the producers and it's really just a vibe. And it's kind of, I like to ask like what the expectations are. Can I, you know, especially with episodic directing, there's just a system in place and everyone's kind of expected like, this is the system and you either like that and are fine with it or you don't and it's fine. It's not for you. I've more often than not, again, especially with comedy, found it's just not really for me. I like to know, am I going to be able to come in and be creative and have a shot list and do my shots and, you know, talk to the DP and call lenses and, you know, ask for certain things with the lighting. And
wait, are you saying you wouldn't be able to call lenses on an episodic show?
A lot of shows, no. A lot of shows, the DPs are very protective of that. And they look at you like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, that's not your job. You know, I mean, more often than not, I think they're appreciative if you come in prepared and you have a shot list. But generally speaking, they're like, this is the lens we shoot this on. And they're not wrong.
Yeah, they know.
Respecting the look of a show is part of your job as an episodic director. And I tried to do that on jobs. It just, there's still like a level of like, am I going to be able to direct or am I here to fill a union mandated position while the showrunner talks to the actors and the actors are like, yeah, I know what I'm doing. Thanks. Like, don't talk to me, you know? And I did a couple where I had not great experiences and I was like, okay, I'm going to say no to most of this stuff. So.
Yeah. And then, so I don't know if this is too personal, but you feel like you can say no to a bunch of shows and still just get a steady stream of income and stuff? Like,
not always. I mean, definitely that's one of those things with having a kid made me go like, oh, I need to say yes to more now. But I still try to look for stuff where I feel like I'm going to be, that's why I like doing pilots is because I like to be involved in shaping the look of a show. And so for me, I would rather, you know, play the long game and, you know, I'll go out for a lot of stuff and not get it. And it's, you know, putting together a presentation, doing a director's treatment book, all the things that nobody tells you when you're becoming a director, like, hey, you're going to have to like put your own money and time and a lot of the time not get paid for it in any fashion. So for me, it's, I have sort of a, I have kind of a list of the things I'd like to do and the list of the type of projects I'm drawn to and the things I'd like to be doing that I'm not getting offered. And I go from there. And then.
And so for when you're trying to get a pilot job, you write, it's like a commercial job, but more so like you write a giant treatment and visuals and.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, it depends on the job. Every once in a while, there's one where I feel like I'm auditioning them more than they're auditioning me. So I'm a little bit less like, yeah, I'm going to come in and blow you away. But generally speaking, for a pilot, a movie, I'm going in with a printed book. I pay a lot of money to get a really nice book printed. I design it myself in Photoshop. I'm pulling visual references. And I find that the more I can kind of overwhelm a producer mm-hmm. with like, here's the script I read. Here are my notes on the script. Here's what I would change. Here's my vision for the show. If you're interested, awesome. Great. I'm the guy. If it's not for you, then like good luck with the show and, mm-hmm. be well. And more often than not, just doing that, they tend to go like, oh, okay, cool. And I also really like being involved in development. Like if I can meet on a script before it's taken out to a studio or to a network, even better, because then I can be involved with the pitching process. And, I do find that the more you can help dictate that stuff and the less surprises there are for people, the more you can kind of do what you set out to do. Yeah. I think it's, and I'm just not drawn to stuff where there's not a real opportunity to do that because I just love that process.
Yeah. It's so fascinating to me because I feel like you recently, as our peers are kind of like leveling up and like are getting to the point where like they can maybe turn things down a little bit more, like the ones that have the most distinctive visual style and like who basically create calling cards for themselves and are notable in a specific way are the ones who are saying no more and more, Whereas like, I feel like I have like the tendency to just be like, it's a job, I'll take it.
Yeah.
And you can't stand out doing that.
Well, and it's a hard, as a person, we're all freelancers at heart. We're mm-hmm. all like, when's the next job? And you feel that stress and that pressure. And so it is the hardest thing in the world to have a job offer and say, no, I don't think I'm going to do it. And it took me a long time to get to a place where I felt comfortable doing that. I mean, I hate disappointing people, and two, I hate rejection, So sure. Like I hate rejecting other people. So for me, it was very hard to do that. But I also just got to a place where I knew what would excite me creatively, and it's painful enough for me to be in situations where I'm not being fulfilled in that way that I just know like whatever joy I get from having a job and having income is going to be offset by how miserable I am actually doing the job. And I don't do it.
Well, let me ask, what does your life look like when you're not specifically on a job for hire? How do you develop? What are the things that you're doing to rustle up that next project?
Avoiding depression is a big part of the process.
Let me recommend a podcast.
Staying busy with just little it's hard. I mean, I don't like downtime. I have avoided it as much as possible. For me, periods like this, I do know what my next job is now. But at the same time, I really want to get to a place where I never have real downtime. I always want to be planting seeds. So for me, it's reading scripts that come in, whether it's official submissions or just I'll ask my agents, like, what's out there? What's being made right now? Or what are, open assignments where it didn't come to me, but I'm like, mm-hmm. maybe I could go in and meet on it and something that's not in my wheelhouse, but I, take a swing. I've gone out for a couple movies recently where I really had no business being in the room, but I wanted to take the swing. And then they're like politely like, yeah, thanks. Bye. You did Keanu? Oh, nice. Okay. Goodbye. But at the same time, I always try to learn something from those experiences. So just reading as much as I can. And then I am at the place now where I do want to be actively developing mm-hmm. stuff from the ground up more.
Right.
So that's what I'd like
TV
to be
and
doing.
Film?
Yeah, both. Yeah. I mean, for selling stuff, for taking something out and selling it, it's really more TV because I've already done that in TV. In movies, the film industry is at a really weird place. And There's some of that that happens, but also the projects that I'm sent because of my resume, generally speaking, I'm just not interested. I get every action comedy that either never gets made or I see and I'm like, well, dodged a bullet there. They're just not for me.
But I mean, obviously, so with Get Out coming out last year, like I feel like that is one of those movies, and even like A Quiet Place, and there's a few other movies where like a filmmaker, especially the kind of newer filmmakers, they go, they see that movie and they're like, damn, I need to make my Get Out. I need to make my Quiet Place, right? But you are like so close to that. Like I imagine, at least in your life, in my brain, it's like you guys made Keanu and Jordan learned a ton of stuff on that movie.
Totally,
right?
Yeah.
That he probably used in Get Out. Like, what about, like, it seems like you're primed for like that movie, right?
Peter, what's your Get Out?
I don't know that I have a Get Out in me, but Jordan absolutely learned a lot, both from Key and Peele and Keanu, and also the process of making Get Out. I mean, I watched the first cut of that I watched, it was a very different movie. And so the process of making that, you know, I know he changed a lot and learned a lot, and it very organically became the movie that you see now. But I think that's the process on anything. It definitely, that and having, you know, knowing people who are doing interesting stuff and meeting filmmakers that you respect, and you know, it does always kind of give you fuel for like, okay, step up. What's next? What are you going to do?
A little creative competition.
Yeah, it's healthy. And so I just like doing things that are different experiences or challenging in some way. I'm about to move to Prague for 7 months to do a show that.
Seven months?
Yeah.
Are you taking your family?
I'm taking my family. We're moving to Prague for a little
while.
Holy
cow.
And it's going to be an adventure, and it could be terrible, but it could be really fun and rewarding. So
you got to try the Pilsner Urquell.
I did try. I was there. We shot the pilot in Prague. I lived there for two months earlier this year. Yeah, yeah. This is Whiskey Cavalier. This is this ABC show that I'm doing. And,
ABC Network show?
Wait.
Yeah.
How many episodes are you doing?
We're doing a half season work. So we're doing 12 additional episodes to the pilot that we already did.
And
so
you're doing all of
them? I'm not directing all of them. No.
Okay.
I'm going to be EPing, and I'll probably direct three of them, mm-hmm. but I'll be running the show in Prague. So there'll be a writer's room with the creator showrunner in LA focusing on the writing side. And then Bill Lawrence and I will be in Prague working on the Prague of
the
it
Prague,
all.
The Prague and of it. Yeah.
Are you, why is it shooting in Prague?
Well, it was, so it's a show that was, the script was set in Europe for the pilot. And originally when I got the job in January, or early February, they said, okay, we're going to shoot it in LA and then we'll do like 4 or 5 days in Europe for exteriors and pickups. And I was like, oh, that's cool. Okay. Yeah. Good plan. And then, Warner Brothers had a show push in Prague. And they had a crew kind of ready and waiting, and they were like, hey, the show pushed. We're going to send you guys to Prague. We'll just do it all in Prague. And I was like, oh, what? Okay. I literally 4 days after I got the job, I was on a plane to go to Prague, and, I worked with a whole new crew I'd never met before and a new DP I'd never worked with before. And,
you didn't get to pick the DP either. It's like 100%.
Well, the DP was American, but for Warner Brothers, because it was a network show, it was a pilot. They have a very powerful showrunner EP in, Bill Lawrence. I very much walked into kind of a turnkey operation. Mm, they already had a DP that they wanted. I got to like interview him as like a cursory,
sure,
DP and make sure. So there was a few people like that. Yeah. He was actually coming off of Lethal Weapon.
Oh, cool. Like,
Warner Brothers is very good about like, hey, you've worked on this show for us. We're going to put you on this pilot or this show.
Sure.
They like their people. And so, I kind of walked into a situation that, again, could have gone really poorly, could have been bad, but it ended up being a lot of fun, and I really enjoyed shooting in Prague. It was a really fun experience.
Wait, but just from like a life point of view, how do you like just tell your wife, like, hey, we just had a kid, I'm going to go to Prague for 2 months? Tomorrow.
It was a very difficult conversation. I have the benefit of an extremely understanding partner who also worked in this industry. We met working on a show together, actually on Key and Peele. She was our location manager. And she understands the nature of the job. And it was tough. It was really hard for both of us. It was hard for my son. It was hard on me. It was tough. But also, it's the job. And sometimes it happens. And communication is your friend, key. But it's not easy.
Yeah, you know? I had this thing. I was going to go to Toronto for the show, which I'm not doing anymore, but I spent like months freaking out about my dogs and my kids and wait, how long will she come? And she has her own job, you know, like, anyway.
We're in that mode right now about Prague, trying to figure out animals. And yeah, I mean, we have a house here. It's like, do we move out of the house? Like, what do we do?
Rent it out. Yeah.
Yeah. So, all questions I'm dealing with now.
Yeah. Yeah. We had Maggie Kylie on the show just the other day and she's been globetrotting and has kids and like.
She has two kids.
Yeah.
Yeah. Husband. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm lucky that my son is 18 months and he's, at that age where we can just throw him on a plane and go and it's not life altering for him.
It's not like school or anything like that.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. But we're looking at preschools there. I mean, it's a lot. So, the opportunity was just such that, I've wanted to work in Europe for a long time. I really like Europe. I didn't go there until last year. It was my first time ever going to Europe in my life, and I fell in love with it. And I came back. We did the Jean-Claude Van Johnson premiere. I did a commercial there in the summer, which was terrible in Budapest, terrible experience. And then we did the premiere of the show in Paris and went all over Europe. And I came back saying, I really want to get a job in Europe. And I went out for a movie that was going to shoot in Europe, didn't get it, and then got this pilot, and it didn't even think it was going to shoot in Europe, and then it did. So it was kind of like, okay,
Meant
to be.
So do you have to hire any Czech directors or anything? Is that part of, like, is there an incentive of any sort that you get?
I mean, the crew is mostly Czech, yeah. I don't know is the honest answer to that. I think mostly, again, Warner Brothers wants to use people that they know and trust. Mm-hmm. So more than likely, there'll be American and UK directors primarily, but... yeah, I mean, I have to familiarize myself with the directing pool of talent in Czech Republic and in Europe in general. I mean, it's really, there's a lot of great people there. So, but we had a really great crew. I really loved shooting in Prague.
I feel like we can ask you so much more stuff, but
but
we should probably wrap things up and get into our final segment that we call Unpaid Endorsements.
Unpaid Endorsements.
So I actually got this one from John Petter, a DP we know. I was with him and I got a call. You know when you get a phone call from a phone number that's like almost your phone number?
Yeah.
Like the neighbor spoof or whatever they call it. And it's always a junk call and you're always like, ugh, these idiots keep calling me and I don't know what to do. And he told me if you're on AT&T, which there was a time where every person with an iPhone was on AT&T. It's not true today, but they have an app called Call Protect. And it's basically exactly like the spam filter on Gmail. You install it on your phone. And if somebody has marked a call as spam, a number, it won't vibrate. It'll just show up as like a missed call and it'll add a message that says probably spam.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
So
Call Protect.
Yes. I'm very excited about it. I've not installed it yet because I'm lazy, but nice. I will do it this week. And if I don't like it, I will unendorse it next week.
We'll keep this posted.
But John loves it, so I'm excited about stopping those insane calls.
Awesome.
Nice.
Cool. Peter, you got anything?
Sure. Yeah, there is also an app that I love that I use. I've used it for several years now, but I always use it for doing overhead blocking maps for stuff, Shot Designer Pro. Okay, good. It's like that thing is a lifesaver. I also have a list of features I wish they would implement.
So
if you work for Shot Designer Pro, hit me up so we can make this thing even better. But it's still
a great
product. I bet
you anything, if you tweeted at them, they would respond.
I don't know. I never think to do that.
I will say this.
I never think that I have a voice.
I just did a big musical number where I leaned heavily on Shot Designer and endorsed it a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
And we just tweeted about it and they liked it. So they're paying attention.
They're out there.
Go for it.
I'm going to tweet them. I'm going to say, guys, let me in on the concept meeting.
I'm curious, what would you change about it?
First and foremost, on the iPad app, there's got to be better ways to do touch controls and resize things. I just feel like it could be quicker.
Do you ever drop in like an image?
Yes, always. Yeah. I have my production designer give me blueprints for sets. Yeah. And
like overhead?
Yeah. Yeah. Always have. That's my number one request for art department is give me a blueprint of every location we're going to. Production designers that I work with a lot now know how I like it, but it's always a process of like, please don't label it. Please, you can do some set dressing, but not stuff that I, you know, but yeah.
Do you know how much it costs?
I think it's like $20 for the full license. But you, if you buy it once, you can get it on your laptop, on your iPad. It you get it for everything. Yeah, for me, the magic time is like sitting at a desk alone at night and just reading the script. And I have a weird system. I should have brought my iPad. But I do it all on my iPad. And I go and I take the script, put it into this program called GoodNotes. And I have a color coding system where I highlight stuff and I write shot ideas. And it looks like a serial killer went through the script and like made his gripes and stuff. But it's super, you know, this weird system. And then I'll translate that into an overhead and a shot list. And, you know, I'll send it to my editor and be like, here's my notes. I put a music idea in here or a cut idea, or I feel like this is going to be a match cut, or, you know, it's kind of just my way of like, let's all get on the same page. Let's all know what we're doing.
And so, that other app you said is GoodNotes.
GoodNotes is a note taker. And that's an app, as another plug, I've gotten everybody on every show I've worked with using GoodNotes by the end of the show, because it's invaluable, especially if you want to be paperless. Like now I don't want anything ever printed out. Just send me a PDF. You can organize it all in GoodNotes. You can make folders and subfolders, and every, you know, shot list, one-liner, overhead, scout notes, you know, everything I do on an iPad Pro with the Apple Pencil and in GoodNotes. Huh. Yeah, I'm a crazy person.
Exciting.
That's awesome. Yeah, if you ever felt like sharing some of those documents with us on things that are already out, it would be really awesome for our
listeners.
More than
happy to, yeah.
Oh, totally. Awesome. That would be... That big sequence from JVCD.
Yeah.
Or JVCJ.
I would love to. Yeah, that was one of those things where, you know, every once in a while you're shooting something and it's so complicated, because that one, Jean-Claude is playing three characters in the scene. So we had to like shoot out his coverage as him and time cop him and the weird Philippe character he plays. So like managing that, when you're in the weeds, you're like, I have no idea if this is going to cut together. I think it is, because I know I got this shot and I don't even remember why I need that shot, but I got that shot. And when it mostly cuts together, you're like, oh, thank God I am a crazy person and planned. Thank God for GoodNotes and Shot Designer Pro.
Awesome, man.
Oh, thank
Long
you.
Long plugs.
Yeah, no, love it. No, it's good. I love like a plug that's also got a little craft to it. But mine is real straightforward. You guys know the shoes Allbirds?
No.
No.
ACs tend to wear them. They're super comfortable and they're really light. And that's my plug. They're just like...
Nice.
They're Allbirds. Like Allbirds. Like, look at all of these birds. And they come in two types. They come in tree and wool. The wool one is like... heavier, basically. It's like a warmer one, but the tree one are the ones that I have. They're super, super breathable and like literally the most comfy shoes I've ever had. So,
cool. And they're for ACs.
Yeah. Yeah. Like multiple ACs. I know wore them. So.
Do you know about Hokas?
No.
Hokas, similar, but worn by stunt people.
Mm.
And they're these shoes with crazy fat soles. You look like an idiot with these shoes, but they're super comfortable too.
I bet they're kind of similar. It's almost like a wedge.
Same.
I would trust the stunt person's shoe more than an AC who's Both. Just sitting they, on a dolly all day.
Oh,
you know?
No, good first AC. They're on their feet all the time. Second AC, actually.
Yeah, that's true. But if you see like a department and they're all wearing the same thing, they're like, what's the deal? Like, they're hip to something.
That's true.
I want to know what it is.
That's true.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Peter.
Thank you.
If listeners want to find out more about you, keep track of all of your awesome work, where can they find you?
Google.com, and then you enter Peter Tinsley. No, I'm occasionally on Twitter, trying to be on Twitter less, at Atencio. and occasionally on Instagram. And I do have a habit of violating NDAs by posting projects I'm working on too early on my website.
Yeah, yeah. Your Instagram is quite good.
Well, thanks.
It's super fun.
I do less of that now.
Fair.
Got a lot of talkings too.
Did you really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, oh man, yeah. That's a bummer.
I got in trouble constantly, especially on Key and Peele. I got in trouble all the time for stuff.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh man, that's a bummer. Well,
oh, it's fine. I'm just an idiot. So, you know.
I say, enjoy Peter's idiocy and look forward to all of his projects.
Yeah, and his website, peterattencio.com, has stuff like new stuff. Whiskey Cavalier.
There is stuff on there. There's
Fraggle Rock.
There's stills on there that ABC probably. I'm developing Fraggle Rock.
Oh,
I'm
that's exciting.
Developing a Fraggle Rock movie for Fox.
Yeah, man.
So hoping that happens.
Knock
soon.
On wood.
Should be fun.
Well, thanks so much, Peter. If you want to follow the show or you have questions or thoughts, we're basically at Just Shoot It Pod on everything. You can follow me at Mr. Matt Emo.
And me at Smitey Pyleg. And if you have any questions for us, write to us at justshootitpod@gmail.com. Check out our Patreon, patreon.com/justshootitpod. Leave us a review on iTunes. This episode was edited by Christopher Robert Gray. It was produced by Madeline Rosewatt, and our webmaster is Ewan Williams. And the music was provided by the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. And thanks for listening.
Thanks, everyone. Nice. Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.